Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This is The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast, and today on the show, we have our first in-person interview since before the pandemic with my fellow Bay Area resident, W. Kamau Bell, who is returning to the podcast for a third time. But first, I am so excited to introduce my friend and fellow editor at The Daily Beast, who is going to be joining us at the top of every episode starting this week. Welcome to the podcast, Allegra Frank.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Yeah, this is so exciting. You know, I think listeners may know you from one of our year-end funniest performances episodes that we've done in the past. But yeah, you and I talk about comedy so much in our actual lives at The Daily Beast that I thought it would be fun to have you on and start, you know, talking about some stuff that we don't always get to talk about on this show. And, you know, I think we're both such big comedy fans with some of the same interests, some different interests. So yeah, this is just, it's very fun to have you here.
Cool. Yeah, I'm excited.
So you help run our Obsessed section. So I thought it would be apt to start by talking about the show that we are both most obsessed with right now, I think, which is Jerrod Carmichael reality show, which just premiered its first episode on this past Friday on HBO. I think we're going to try to keep our conversation mostly to the first episode so we don't spoil anything beyond that. But I will say that you and I have both watched all 8 episodes. You because you had to review it or got to review it. And I, because I got the screeners and just couldn't stop.
Yeah. I mean, again, we will not spoil it, but I feel like it just kind of builds. And the first episode is so grabby that you kind of just want to keep watching it anyway. But then as the story builds, it's just very, you know, it just really brings you in. I just really wanted to know what was happening, which makes it sound way more like a narrative plotty show than it is. But there's just so much going on that's really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, the second I watched the first episode, since you were the only other person I knew who had already seen it, I immediately messaged you and I was like, so that's Bo Burnham, right? Talking about the anonymous masked man with the ski mask and the goggles and the pitched down voice who appears in that first episode. And I saw it and I immediately knew who it was. I'm not sure if you're supposed to know who it is or not, but what was your reaction? Because I don't think that you had that immediate takeaway.
No, I have watched the first episode 3 times now. And the second time was because you had said that, because that anonymous man ends up appearing again. So I had seen the entire show and I'd seen that guy multiple times, this, you know, wearing a ski mask, wearing goggles, his voice is pitched down. I just was like, I just assume this is one of his probably famous friends and he does not want to be on the show. Like, just didn't know who, had no guesses.
Yeah, I mean, Jerrod has a lot of famous friends. I think he was like hanging out with Taylor Swift recently. Like, you know, you never know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I just was like, okay, this is just one of his friends. It's not... no one who's, you know, relevant here, probably famous, but not someone where I would even know. But then you figured it out so fast. And then watching it again, I was like, oh, okay, of course this 6'12" guy who's so awkward is Bo Burnham. Like, that makes so much sense. And they've worked together. Like, we know they are very close friends. And Bo Burnham does not love to talk about himself explicitly, which is sort of what his character or his role as Anonymous is getting at, that he is very opposed to Jerrod's ethos here.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I saw it and I was like, I was pretty sure it was him. And then I Googled and found the Reddit threads where they're breaking it down and showing photos of Bo wearing that same ski mask and goggles at the Emmys, which are in this first episode. I guess it's the 2022 Emmys. Yeah, because the show has been in the works for a while. But yeah, that was definitely one part of the episode that stood out to me. The other one that I think has gotten more attention probably is that scene between Gerard and Tyler, the creator, that is towards the end of the episode. It's this incredibly emotional, awkward, but also really funny scene where Gerard is basically, you know, confronting Tyler, the creator, about this crush that he's had on him for a while. The episode opens with Gerard on stage saying, "I fell in love with my best friend," and sort of telling the story of how this all played out. But then we finally get to see them talk about it together on camera in this very sort of meta, sort of performative, hard to figure out way. So yeah, what did you think of that scene? Because it was really something.
Yeah, it was so uncomfortable. Just because Tyler, the creator, to my mind, is not a particularly serious person. His music can be, but as a persona, I often think of him as, like, you know, Loiter Squad was very silly, his Adult Swim prank show with Odd Future. He's just a very goofy guy. So the idea of having a serious conversation with him, especially knowing that his initial response, as Gerard says in the beginning of the episode, to being told his best friend's in love with him, was just like, "Ha ha, you stupid bitch." Like, his response already was so unserious that I had to, you know, I knew he was going to play it off with humor, which makes it so uncomfortable, but also at the same time, it ends up kind of coming around to being sort of funny, where it's like, this is so ridiculous and both of these guys are so unable to express themselves, and they're comedians anyway. But it was hard to watch. It was hard to watch. And, you know.
Yeah, it was. I mean, and it's one of the many moments in this episode in the series that are sort of playing with the tropes of reality shows. And obviously it's called Gerard Carmichael Reality Show. And, you know, I'm not someone who watches a lot of reality shows, so I don't know, like, how this fits into that landscape. Maybe the way some other people who are, like, reality show junkies who watch this, also, they might be confused. But, you know, what did you think of sort of the way that the show is playing with these reality show tropes and sort of showing us the camera sometimes, showing us the crew? It's like trying to call attention to it, but I can't tell how real it is.
Yeah, something I found sort of frustrating at first was it really was trying to be meta, where it acknowledges the artifice to an extent where he invites the crew into his front door and we see them, you know, taking their shoes off and talking to him and setting things up. He talks to a guy, he invites a guy from Grindr over, and the guy sleeps over, and then in the morning they're talking and the guy says to him, "This is the first time I've hooked up with someone," who then immediately said, "The camera crew is coming." Like, just there's all these things where they really acknowledge the fact that this is a show and it is a performance in some way. But I think that it gets to use the conventions of reality shows in a good way, in that people are doing things they would never actually do in real life, which is being their most vulnerable self. And I think that's what attracted him to the medium, right? Is that he wants to be more honest with himself, and he sees the reality show as a place where inherently you have to say everything. And so he's finally going to make himself do that.
Yeah, he's really been pushing himself in that direction of honesty. I mean, obviously with Rathaniel, which was the special that he put out, you know, before this, and that's the one that he's going to the Emmys for, which is the one where he came out on stage and talked. And that's like a very funny special in some ways, but also a very intense and serious and sad special in all of it, that Bo Burnham directed, of course. And then, you know, before that he was doing Carmichael Show, which he was playing this sort of like version of himself that now feels like so not who he is. And I wonder if it was at all who he was at that time. But that was like as if it was portraying his family in that show. But now we're like seeing his family in this show, especially as it goes on. So yeah, he certainly seems to be pushing himself towards honesty, revealing himself. But at the same time, I'm watching and thinking, he knows there are cameras there. He knows we're going to watch this. So how much of it is a performance? So it is just really fascinating on so many levels. Like it's way beyond, you know, what he's been able to do, I think, in his other shows.
Yeah, it definitely feels like a sequel to Rathaniel in a way, like emotionally, in terms of that was him saying he's done with secrets. And now he's trying to really hold to that, which is really interesting to see, where it's like, you know, he did something so vulnerable on such a massive scale, and now he's trying to continue to do that. Like, I feel as though that's a kind of cool thing to see, especially doing it in such a way where it's like 4 hours straight of this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's fascinating. And it'll be interesting to kind of revisit it too as it goes along. You know, hopefully we can talk about it again, because they are rolling it out week to week as opposed to dropping it all at once. So I think, and each episode kind of has a different focus. And I think people will really like, who are into it, will follow along and kind of, I think, hopefully maybe take some more time with it than we did binging it all at once, which you're not supposed to do.
Yeah. I'm definitely going to have fun rewatching it. Like, I've rewatched it last night, and I'm going to just keep going each week. So it'll be fun to see what people are saying, because there's definitely some cringy moments that I think people want to talk about.
Yeah. The other thing that really came to mind watching it was, like, it does feel so new in this genre of comedians making shows about themselves where they sort of play versions of themselves. And obviously he did it already with Carmichael's show, but then there are things like, you know, Louis, which we don't really talk about anymore. And, you know, Curb Your Enthusiasm, things where comedians are playing sort of versions of themselves. But here he's just showing us himself in as real a way as he sort of has been able to. But then it also at the same time reminded me of Seinfeld, in the sense that it's interspersed with these stand-up bits that relate to the themes of the show. So he's sort of even playing with that tradition as well.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really interesting to see, because that is such a classic, you know, self-insert comedy thing, but it feels like a very sad Seinfeld, honestly.
Yeah.
Just like, yeah, incredibly sad.
Yeah.
Yeah. Extremely serious, very vulnerable, like funny, but just deeply, deeply sad funny, which I kind of like. I like a
so
sad
if you're listening
Seinfeld
to this and haven't watched it yet, if that makes you want to watch it, then you're on our page. And if it doesn't, then you're not. Yeah, I mean, speaking of Seinfeld, next weekend is the series finale of Curb Your Enthusiasm, which I know we're going to be talking about on this show next week. I'm very excited for that. And obviously, we haven't seen it yet, so we can't talk about it yet. But I am curious for you, you know, before seeing it, how certain are you that this is really going to be the end for Curb Your Enthusiasm, that Larry David is actually walking away this time?
I'm pretty sure he's done. Like, he has had people reference the Seinfeld finale to him in the show. Like, someone just sort of offhandedly was like, oh, you left Seinfeld, but you came back for the finale, right? And then it kind of does the thing the show does where they like hold on it a little too long because it's going to be important. So I feel like if this season is sort of him remaking the Seinfeld finale in a way, just like very slow and long, that's going to be weird to then be like, okay, and now we're doing more. Like, it really feels like he's trying to do final show again. Like, because the final episode he did before was so infamous, I feel like he's trying to use this to rewrite that.
Yeah. And the fact that he's building towards a trial and possible prison time is significant as well.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll have to see if he makes it out of jail. Or, I mean, honestly, he's like, I forget if he's even supposed to be going to jail, but this rich man is like, he's going to have to pay a fine and he's going to have to go to jail. Like, it's going to be so absurd.
Well, yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to watching that and then talking with you about it next week. What I want to do now, though, is go to our interview for this week, which is with W. Kamau Bell, as I mentioned. We recorded it in a studio in Oakland shortly after I saw one of his residency shows at Berkeley Rep that was really fun. And yeah, I mean, he's someone who hasn't been doing much stand-up recently, but he's trying to get back into it. And one of the big things I talked to him about was this deep ambivalence he's feeling about whether he's even a comedian anymore after being a CNN host and directing this Cosby documentary that came out a couple years ago. So yeah, I'm just looking forward to seeing how that all progresses. But we had a really great conversation. And before we get into the interview, I thought we could listen to a clip from his 2018 Netflix special, Private School Negro, about what he thinks is the best show on TV.
Doc McStuffins is one of the greatest TV shows in the history of television. Not one of the greatest kids TV shows, one of the greatest television shows. I'll put it up against The Wire and The Sopranos any day. I watch that show. I'm excited for new episodes. Let me explain. Doc McStuffins is about a little black girl who's 6 years old, and she's a doctor for her stuffed animals and toys. and she wears a stethoscope, and it's magical, and when it makes a sound, all the toys come to life. They don't explain how it works. I don't know, voodoo, I don't know what it is. But when her toys have problems, like they break their arm or they're feeling tired, she tells them what to do. Like, you need to take a nap. Here's a cast. It's like, and she, so she's actively being a doctor on the show as a six-year-old black girl. Have I blown your mind yet? There's more. So it gets kids ready to go to the doctor, not afraid of the doctor, but it also teaches kids how to speak up for themselves in general. There was an episode about inappropriate touching. There was an episode where one of the stuffed animals was like, well, of course storms are getting worse. That's global warming. Holy shit! Doc is more woke than our president!
Well, Kamal, this is great to have you here. We are both in the Bay Area. Very exciting.
Yeah, welcome to the Bay Area.
Thanks, man.
I mean, I know you've been here for a while, but I feel like as the showbiz mayor of the Bay Area.
Yeah, I feel very welcomed by you. That's very nice. Yeah, this is your third time on this podcast.
I remember I was on early because I demanded it.
You were the first to request to be on, which felt good at the time. Yeah, that was early in 2019, and then you were on for the Cosby doc, and now you've joined the coveted Three Timers Club. I don't know if you're aware; it's kind of a big deal.
I mean, I'll take it.
Some
I'll
other
take
members
it.
Include Jenna Friedman,
okay, good,
Jordan Klepper, and Roy Wood Jr.
This is good company.
Nate Bargatze.
This is really good company.
Yeah, it's getting better, right? Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know Nate, but I have that weird like comedy pride for Nate. Like
he's really doing it.
Yeah, and that SNL was like so like that dude showed up.
Yeah, that was on point. That was good.
Yeah. So Nate, wherever you are, I'm proud of you, even though I don't think we've met.
I feel like even more exciting than your third time on this podcast. This is our first in-person taping since early 2020, which is insane. It's been more than 4 years.
I'm glad I can help sort of, again, I'm a trailblazer. We know that about me.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, it worked out because we're both in the East Bay. I moved here just about a year ago and you've been here for quite a while. You've managed to have a showbiz career from Northern California, which is impressive.
I was remote before it was cool. I was Zooming before it was a thing. Yeah.
Well, I was really excited to go check out your residency that you were doing at Berkeley Rep, which was right down the street from me. It was called W. Kamau Bell Gets His Act Together, which felt appropriate. How did it go for you?
You know, it's funny. It's only 8 shows, so you can't be like, I'm ready. I'm back, baby. It's, you know, it was definitely like it was humbling in a lot of ways because I sort of put a lot on my plate. Like to sort of not, I didn't do a new hour every week, but I'm working on a new sort of like arc of material. And I just was very aware that like as I was getting the itch to go back to stand up, as my wife was like, you need to go back to stand up. I was like, I can't, I just knew I couldn't go as much as I love like the punchline here in the city and or in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. I can't go to the punchline for 7 minutes on a Sunday. First of all, the next day is a school day.
Yeah.
Like I can't. So there's that. It's just like, I can't be out at 10 o'clock on a Sunday night because it'll ruin my morning for my kids. So how can I do this? And the Berkeley Rep had years ago reached out and said, if you ever want to do something. So I just took a chance and shot in the dark. I was like, hey. And then when I found that little 60-seat theater they had, I was like, this is exactly what I wanted. So it was – and it was also humbling because, like, there was some, like, whoo, you know. And
there's
so
some moments.
There's moments, whole shows of, like, you know, like, you know, you know, where you're just like, I don't know if I – it's been a long time. And you know, first of all, the big thing is like, do I really want to do this? Because it's got to be fun. It can't feel like homework. I can't do stand up like it's homework. Do I even have the like the mental space and energy for this? Because when I was a stand up back in the day, that's all I thought about all day long. Stand up comedy.
Now you have a lot more to think about.
I have a lot more to think about. Overall, it sort of has like, I definitely feel like, oh, there's something here. Like, you know, like that's, I mean, there's just the like, yeah, you know, there's something here.
You talked during the show about how part of the reason why you wanting to do this now is that it's an election year and, you know, you've always had a political element to your comedy. You had one bit the night that I saw you that really stood out to me, which was the comparing Joe Biden to a toddler walking down the stairs.
Yes. Yes.
Which I thought really encapsulated something because it sort of addressed the issue, but it with some empathy.
Yes.
Because you sort of are feeling for him.
Yeah.
So how did you think about that and sort of how to talk about that? Because it's kind of a fraught thing, right? Like,
yeah,
how much are we okay drawing attention to this?
I mean, I think there's one of the real thrusts of the show is also me accepting my own old age. And, you know, as far as like, you know, I'm 51 now. So like, which am I allowed to say that in show business? So like, I really feel like I'm allowed to have these conversations now in a way that I wasn't allowed to, that people didn't, weren't going to allow me to have them. So I think, first of all, I'm going to claim that I'm in a state in my life where I'm like, it's not as, things aren't as smooth as they used to be. And I'm tired and I'm not sure about this. And I can see this, the arc of the country, and it's all going downhill. So now I'm going to look at the guy who's leading us, and I get to comment on this in a way that I maybe wasn't as comfortable commenting before, and leaning into it. And I think I really, when Stewart came back and people were so mad at him talking about how old Joe Biden was, I was like, fuck this, man. like, you can't even say so. An old person's old. And so for me, but then also like there is a sense of like, this is our, with the way electoral politics works, this is our best bet, you know, and that like.
Yeah, the sort of the nervousness. But I mean, that also plays into, I mean, I think the reason why people were mad at Jon Stewart, or some people were, is that it was, you know, these are the options. So if you're going to say they're both terrible, where does that leave us? Yeah. Do you worry about that at all?
It's funny. Like, I know that people say this about Stewart, but he's the Pope of the liberals, you know, like sort of the liberal Pope. And I think that like the one thing that Stewart has always been sort of maintained that I used to not understand that now I understand is like, I'm not trying to do that. Like, I'm not trying to be the Pope of the liberals. You can. And so I think we spend too. How do I put this? I think we, if democracy is so delicate that comedians can't make fun of it, we're in trouble.
We are in trouble. Though.
Yeah. So, but I think the idea being that we're putting the pressure on the wrong parts of this. You know what I mean? Like, it's not that I think that like, and you know, if comedians, I think if you want to yell at Stewart for saying it, fine. The same way you can yell at any comedian for saying anything you don't agree with. But I think when people had their feelings hurt, like they thought Stewart was supposed to carry water, it's like, that's like, I mean, you're taking his job away from him. Yeah. And, you know, so I think that like, we are in trouble, and I recognize that. Like, I certainly recognize that, but I'm not expect Jon Stewart to save me. Like, I'm looking at the wrong person to save me. And I think that like, you know, even when I see like a headline about something Joe Rogan says, I'm like, dude, why are we quoting Joe Rogan? Like, you know what I mean? Like,
we're putting too much stock in these guys.
We're putting too much, you know, like, and really, I do think that like the Biden administration should feel pressure to stand up to the fears of Americans who think he's too old. Do something about it. I think Stewart's best bit that night was like, show me these meetings where he's like, maybe you should get some video of him being in control of everything.
If you're telling us behind the scenes he is sharp and full of energy and on top of it and really in control and leading, you should film that. That would be good to show to people instead of a TikTok where he goes, chocolate chip cookie. We see he's in charge. You see, I like cookies.
So I think that people are so afraid, they would rather focus their ire on Stewart than on themselves and go, well, what can I do? So I feel very comfortable with Stewart making those jokes because I know that I'm also looking at myself like, what can I do? And I think a lot of people just want, they would rather Jon Stewart be in charge of getting the vote out than having to get the vote out themselves.
Yeah. When you mentioned Rogan, it reminded me of something that happened this week in Oakland, which was RFK Jr.'s big announcement. We just had a piece run in the Daily Beast about how comedians, a certain type of comedian, have really lined up behind RFK, Rogan being one of them. He's doing the serious rounds of the comedy podcasts. And really seems to be.
Who is Andrew Schultz going to endorse?
Yeah, I mean, but this is they have more sway than you might want to admit, I guess, right?
I mean, I guess, but I don't know that, like, do they have more sway? That's a good question. Like,
they have a lot of listeners, I guess.
They have a lot of listeners. Yeah, they have a lot of listeners. They have a big audience, and those people are going to listen. But I don't know that they're actually like Rogan also. Remember when he was a fan of Bernie Sanders and his listeners got mad, his audience got mad? I just think that, like, I really, first of all, I think with Rogan, I think if you allowed me to book his show for a year, his whole perspective would change. Like, I just think that
he's
Rogan
easily swayed by the person who's talking
to him. In front of him. So if I just spent a year booking like my friends, like, you know, like my like Black Lives Matter activists and leaders and black religious leaders and trans people, like his whole perspective would shift. So I really, I have a hard time believing, you know, that I have a hard time. I'm not worried about that, about RFK doing the comedy podcast circuit. RFK is weirdly, his least best advocate is RFK Jr. So, and there's always going to be the kind of person who wants to believe in that type of person.
Are there enough of them that are going to sway the election of Trump, I guess, is the main question.
The bigger thing, and this is what I feel like, the bigger thing, man, is that no matter who the next president is, this country might be fucked. So I don't. That so for me, it's like I think if we Boots Riley, another East Bay showbiz person, where he said this years ago, he said that like people cast voting is the most you can do for democracy, and it's really the least you can do for democracy. So for me, like I think we will get to November. Those of us who vote will vote. I actually think local races are more important than the presidential election. It's also let's not get caught up in the fact that we're in California. If me and you vote for Biden, that does not put Biden over the top because of how the Electoral College works. So I think we get caught up in all this sort of like da 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 da. I get that if you're in Wisconsin and in Pennsylvania and Georgia, that's a different calculus. But we don't live there. Maybe you're moving to Georgia. But I think that like if we act like this, the whole election swings on the whole future of the country swings on who's the president. We've misunderstood the problem. We've misunderstood the America. So. That's my feeling about it. It's like, I'm not saying don't vote. I'm saying absolutely vote. Please vote. Register to vote. Check your voter registration. But don't act like your vote for president is going to save America. So I think the idea being that like the system is suffering. Please vote for president. But I'm not going to like protest against the beef I would have with Joe Rogan is not going to be the RFK Junior beef. Like I'd way rather sit him across from some trans activists than the RFK Junior.
You went on his show, right?
Yeah, I was on his show twice, but like way pre
when it was different.
It was different. I mean, it was like, you know, Joe is like a wind vane. You know, like it was like it was. I think it was pre that New York Times IDW article. Like I remember being like, this guy's a handful. But he was also, he'd expressed that he liked my work and he reached out to me the first time. He reached out to me to be on the show. So I wasn't trying to get it. Second time I went on and I was like, all right, that was good. Like, but I didn't feel any need to go back. And then, but then this was pre-Spotify, you know, he's a fan of comedians, which is speaks well to him, but it was way pre all the current version of it.
Yeah. Is it something you would do if he asked you to come back on?
Nah.
Just don't need it.
Maybe I do need it, but I just don't want it. Like, I've had friends who go on and I'm like, how'd that go? And they're like, it's like a lot to have to sort of, because you don't know.
I've heard that from people as well.
You don't know what he's going to say that has nothing to do with why you showed up to talk that is going to end up being clipped. And one of my friends got clipped like that. I was like, how is that? Like, you know, like, cause Joe went off on some tangent and suddenly you're in the clip about the thing that you weren't there to show up. And
you're just sucked in.
You're just the person across from me who's shaking his head. Yes. Waiting for the subject to change. And I just don't, I would only go on that show if I was like, can I bring some people with me? People who I would love to put you across from.
Yeah. That's more like intervention than podcast.
Yeah, exactly. But I not to just, it's not, you know, it's my career is a lot of things, but it is not a by any means necessary. Do I need to be successful? You know, there's a reason why, you know, like there's a reason why I'm not Kevin Hart. Like a lot of reasons, tons of reasons. But like, I'm not.
You're not trying to be Kevin Hart.
I'm not trying to be. And I mean, at one point I would have said I was, but like 20 years ago, but I'm not trying to sit across from bad faith arguments, you know, unless it's like, that's the project I'm doing. Like I'm going to sit across from the Klan because I'm here to show you what the Klan is doing, but I'm not. And I don't want to look like I'm like, I hope he doesn't bring that up because I don't want to have to, you know, I just don't want to deal with it. I'm old. Life's too short. I only have a few years left.
Coming up, Kamau opens up about the reluctance he feels about being a stand-up comic right now. And later, while the fallout from his four-part docuseries, We Need to Talk About Cosby, may not have ended his career as he predicted it might the last time we talked, it has forever changed it.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're enjoying this episode and want to hear more, please make sure you are following The Last Laugh wherever you get your podcasts. By subscribing to The Last Laugh, you can listen to our previous two episodes with W. Kamau Bell, as well as conversations with other comedians who got their start on his late-night show, Totally Biased, including Hari Kondabolu and Aparna Nancherla, along with everything else from our free archive. And you'll be the first to hear new episodes when they drop every Wednesday. And while you're at it, please leave a rating and review on Apple and Spotify to let us know how much you love the show and who you want to hear next. Now, back to W. Kamau Bell. This idea of sort of ambition and what you really want to be doing was something that really came through at the Berkeley Rep show. You know, you were sort of commenting on maybe there were moments where you felt like you'd rather be home with your family than being there, which I thought was, you don't hear from comedians, I think you especially don't hear from male comedians much. So it was interesting to hear that.
Was that the night I was talking about, like, the ice cream?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that was a real thing. Like, I walked on stage and my 9-year-old, Kamau Jr., as I talked about in the show probably, texted me and was like, we were trying to make ice cream and it messed up. And I literally was like, fuck, I gotta go.
Yeah. You're like, I need to be saving the ice cream.
I gotta go help this kid. She used whole milk. She should have used half and half. The babysitter didn't know it was half and half. And I can go home. I can fix this problem in a half hour if I go home right now. And we'll sit around and have ice cream and have a good. Yeah. So I that's the other thing about stand up. If I do it, it really takes me away from home. And I travel a good bit anyway. And I just like I just. I mean, one, I think I like my kids. And even when I'm telling jokes about my kids, I'm trying to, I want it to be clear that I like them. Even if I'm calling my little one like a feral. Like, she is feral, but I love her for her feralness. But, like, I really do, like, I want to work and provide for my family, but I don't want to be gone all the time. And so the idea of going on the road and doing, like, dates and clubs is just like, oh, no. You know, because, and it's, you know, so... Even when I talked to my agent about it, it was like she started to send me some dates for like clubs around the country. And I was just like, oh, God, no. And so is there a way to be a stand up and be a good dad?
That is a question. Yeah,
it is a question. And I think that's, I would say for a lot of comedians, that's a question that's up in the air. And how do you define good dad is the first. So for me, it was just like my kids like it when I'm around. And there's going to be a point where they don't like that. And I like to be around them. So, yeah, no, it was really, that night was funny. I really did have like my instinct was to leave. And I was like, and so for me, and then I want to like, well, I want to talk about this because this is actually, I know I'm not in a place now where I need the audience the way I used to. So I want you to know, like, I'm staying, but.
Like, yeah. I mean, to me, that was sort of the most fascinating part about the show was that ambivalence and reluctance. And, you know, because we think of comedians as being so, you know, that's all they care about. And they get up, you know, 12 times a week and
12,
whatever.
Yeah, 12 times a night. If you're Steve Byrne.
But yeah, I mean, at this point in your career, you're sort of trying to figure out whether you are still a stand-up comedian, right? I mean, you've joked about that you retired, maybe not on purpose. Yeah. But do you feel like you are going to come back? Would you want to do another special? I think it's been, what, 6 years since the Netflix special?
Yeah. I mean, so the fast answer is yes, I'd love to. But the real answer is like, do I want to do the work that it takes to do that? And what does that work look like? So like, really, I think in those 8 shows I did at the Berkeley Rep, I was like, okay, there's a few chunks here that like could be continued that I would like to work on, not could be worked on. I'm like, oh, this thing is okay. Yeah, there's more here that I enjoy. And so once I found something that I enjoyed, yes, now I can't go do a special today because it would be one of those specials where you're like, I can see what he was thinking. So I think the question is there a way to do it that works for my life? Which is why even going to the Berkeley Rep is a way of like, I get to stay in town. They're going to let me do more time. Is there a way to do it in a way that like I can build this next hour of material and feel good about it? I don't want to, like, if I'm just playing around on stage, I don't want to do that. But it feels like if I feel like I'm working towards something and it feels like I'm sharpening it and there's a real point that I'm making. Because the other thing I want to do is I do want to say something that feels unique to me. Like, you know, it's easy to write. Like, even the jokes about my kids, I'm trying to, like, these are my jokes about my kids. These are not the, and so I like hearing you say that because, like, these are not, they don't sound like other people's jokes about their kids or other relationships to their kids. Mm-hmm. And so that's the first thing is, like, is this something that I really need to say that feels, like, unique to me? Because there's a million specials out there. And it'll just be another special uploaded to YouTube. So if I can do that and then have time to work on it. So I've talked to the Berkeley rep. They're like, they're interested in continuing. And I'm like, okay, what does that look like? So, and does it go more like, it's like, I don't know if I joked tonight, you were there. Am I in my Mike Birbiglia era? Is it like, yeah. Does it go yeah. more theatrical, which sort of feels like maybe I'm there. Cause I think for a long time, I thought stand-up comedy had to happen in comedy clubs 12 times a night. It's in 7 to 15 minute increments, and you had to do it multiple times a week. And I thought, well, if I'm not doing that, then I'm not a stand-up comedian.
Yeah. Did you ever feel really comfortable doing that? Was that your, did it always feel like it wasn't quite your thing? Those, you know, 7 minute chunks.
It's certainly when my career started to come together is when I stopped doing that. When I started doing black box theaters and like did the W Kamau Bell curve, and I had like video and da da da, like video. That was when I felt like, oh, this is actually work that I enjoy and it's good work, and I can like, so I never fiended for it the way that comedians fiend for it. Like any stage time, I don't care if anybody's there. If it's one person, I'm going on stage. I'm always trying to kill. Like, you know, when I'd see those things, like Steve Byrne, for example, had the thing where he did like 13 sets in a night. I was like, sounds exhausting. Like, it sounds like makes my heart palpitate. So I was never a road dog. I always, people would offer me gigs. I'd be like, okay. Like it was like, so, and I think on some level, I realized that's going to mean that I'm not going to be the kind of comedian maybe I thought I was going to be. Like I'm, you know, you grew up watching Eddie Murphy on Raw. Like, I don't think I'm going that path. Well, is there a path for me? And it wasn't until I started doing the solo show, the Bell Curve, which I think of as like, it was still a stand-up comic show, but it was not like, it had PowerPoint and slides and stuff, which then became a thing a lot of comedians do. So, but I think this, I really do want to do stand-up. So I'm not trying to go like the same route, but there might be some visual. Even Hasan Minhaj, I was like, which is funny to see him and sort of the thing, it's sort of this hybrid thing. So I feel like maybe it's that. But and with the having the support of a theater like the Berkeley Rep feels like I have a little bit of like I have an institutional support that is different than like going to the Punch on a Sunday. I mean, they put me up. I think they would, but it just feels like I want to feel free to fail and figure it out.
Yeah. I mean, that one person show thing and the sort of the line between that and a stand up comedy hour has certainly gotten blurred a lot, especially with people like Birbiglia and Hasan.
Well, which is like the same as like in the UK, it was always blurred. Like, so I always, whenever I look at the UK, it's like, they don't seem to care what, if you're on stage for an hour and you're a comedian, it can be hilarious. It can be a bunch of wordplay or it can be like slower stories. And I always admired that. And I feel like we have blurred that. We started to blur that over here because of people like Hannah Gadsby and like other people sort of like, and Hasan, and like there's just a sense of like, oh yeah. So I think that like if I can do that, I mean, I got offered a gig recently, like a stand-up gig, and I'm like in a regular, like not a, like in a nightclub, not a comedy club, and I'm like, am I ready for that? Beer and
it's a different thing.
Cheering. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I'm, you know, and then I would like, but then I would watch Lewis Black. And I think even though Lewis Black is a very real stand up, it always feels a little more theatrical with Lewis Black because he's like, there's a point, he's not in a club and there's a point he's trying to make and there's usually a whole theme. And so I just watched his special recently. And so I feel like maybe my Lewis Black Mike Birbiglia era.
So I like it. I mean, it does seem the other part of your career that's really taken off is this documentary stuff. I mean, starting with United Shades, I think, which I was curious that, so that ended in 2022. Yes. The last season aired. Was that, were you ready to end it? Was it something that, you know, part of the CNN regime change? Or
no, it was definitely all regime change. Yeah. It was definitely like, I sort of saw the end coming before the public knew, because I just sort of knew.
Yeah, they kind of, they took away a lot of the original programming, Stanley Tucci and
all of
it,
all their doc series. I guess they're still doing some sort of documentaries, but yeah, they sort of, the department that was run by Amy and Telus, original series and documentaries, they just sort of like, you know, so when they canceled Stanley Tucci, I was like, yeah. They don't want an A-list actor eating pasta. I get that my time has come to an end here. They don't want any Lisa Ling. So
yeah, how'd you feel about it? I mean, you've been doing it for 7 seasons. Were you ready to be done with it?
I mean, every season I was trying to evolve the show, and I think I was always trying to evolve the show faster than CNN wanted me to. But if you look at season 1 to season 7, it's clear that the show was like constantly like sort of like even like the number of people who worked on it. And so I feel like by the last 3 seasons we were with ZPZ, and Mo Fallon became, who's was a longtime Bourdain producer, was like the my main creative partner there at that point. And we really were finding a groove. And so, but I think that ultimately maybe the show was never going to like end up in the place where I wanted it to be. So, you know, so I sort of look at it as like, oh, maybe I can, now that it's done, I can sort of, you know, like if you look at Bourdain's career, his first show is called A Cook's Tour. And then if you look, and then he goes to the Travel Channel, and then he goes to CNN, you can see that, like, it's the same guy, but he's gotten better at what he's doing, and the show is becoming more and more him.
So that's something you've thought about, too, is sort of a new version of that, thing. What would you change if you were able to sort of have that fresh start?
I mean, CNN never wanted it to be as funny as I wanted it to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, I think that they...
How did that work? Did they were taking stuff out, or...?
There was one, and I had great people there, great execs, but was it the last season? Yeah, it was the last season. We had an episode where it was this, I was doing Man on the Street, and this woman, and this part of the clip's in the show. It's the episode we did about woke in Arizona, the war on woke. We were early to the war on woke. And this older white lady basically says, like, the Irish had it worse than slaves. And we sort of go through this whole thing. I was like, really? She's like, she said slaves were better taken care of than the Irish. And I was like, well, that's because you take better care of your property than you do of the, you know. And so we went back and forth. And then she goes, like, and we sort of went in this long conversation. She says, you know, the Chinese know more about our history than Americans know about our history. I was like, oh, so we should teach an accurate version of our history, like genocide of Native Americans, American slave trade. She's like, no, not the whole thing. And we sort of went back. And finally, when she walked away, I turned to the camera and I went, help me. Like, it was like, because it was just like this crazy circular logic of like, but you just said. And so I turned to the camera and I go, help me. And it was hilarious. And there was a moment where somebody was like, that, like, they kept asking us to take it out. And we just kept going, well, no, that's funny, really. And they were like, and to me, it was like, you don't want me to look human. You don't want me to look like the, you want me to, they sort of, I get that you, I'm not a journalist. You know, I'm not a journalist. I'm a comedian. You don't want me to look like this moment sucks for me, but I'm not like crying. I'm actually making it into a joke. And the fact that they wanted to cut that out, I was like, what am I supposed to do here? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, so for me, it was like, so that then is, if I can't do that, yeah, we can't pitch more like overtly comedic things. Cause I think there's, of course you can mix the sad with the profound, with the funny. It's just that they weren't into it. So we got away with a lot, but also, like, I just think it, like, it wasn't as, like, the thing that happened with the Cosby Project, and this is hard to say, separate from what it was about, was that you got to see him. I got to go, oh, I do have good ideas. I can be in charge. Oh, the weird things that I think that would work, if people let me do them, we can actually find out that some of them work. Not all of them work, but, like, so there's things in that Cosby thing that, like, that are actually explicitly comedic or just weird and quirky that I couldn't do at CNN. And I got to go, it sort of was like a refreshing, like, oh, I do have good ideas. And that's by far the best reviewed thing I've ever had in my
career. Yeah. I mean, that was an incredible series. We talked right when it was coming out, so it kind of hadn't been received in this yet. But you expressed some concerns about the effect that it would have on your career, you know, and that there would be some sort of backlash to it. What was that experience like of putting it out? And did you feel that? Or, I mean, you said it was one of the best reviewed things. So there was certainly a lot of positive, but did you get negative feedback?
Yeah, I got
a
lot of negative feedback. My comments were sort of in flames for a while on the internet. And yeah, I mean, you know, of course I did. But I always sort of knew that I'd get the worst feedback would come from people who weren't going to watch it. I mean, I went to the MLK rally in Oakland on MLK today. When was that? In January. And, like, I was walking around and I was, you know, and I'm by myself like I am a lot. And people would come up to me and say stuff. And one guy came up to me and was like, brother, I was with you up until you did that Cosby thing. And we had a whole conversation about it. So that's just walking around Oakland where I'm supposed to be, like, and he wasn't a jerk about it, but he was very clear. And I sat and had the conversation with him. And then it turned out by the end, I was like, I get it. Did you see it? Not all of it. Great. Like,
yeah.
Like, I was like, maybe you'll watch it and still hate it. But yeah, there's definitely, like, rooms I walk into where I can sort of feel, especially black rooms sometimes, where you feel people like, like, you know. And the thing I think is my best asset is that I still show up to those places and I look people in the eye and I engage in conversation. So, but yeah. And, you know, I don't know what everybody sort of in the, you know, I haven't had conversations with everybody who would have an opinion about that. So yeah, but I definitely, it has been a net plus, but it's certainly a thing. And I've been surprised by the reactions of some people who, like, did like it, and some people liked it, but liked it quietly. And so I really like that, you know, and it really made me sort of really feel like the people who showed up and had the conversation, I really will always be grateful for, especially the comedic voices like Chris Spencer and Godfrey. You know, like, who showed up and did the thing and were great. Even putting Godfrey in there was, like, a thing that, like, that like he brought a very specific energy to it that nobody you wouldn't normally put in a cop that you wouldn't think of in a doc like that. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite moments is like he's talking about Dick Gregory, how Dick Gregory talked to white audiences, and Godfrey's like, he would just get up there and tell white people to their face, and you'd sit back and be like, nigga. And an editor who we brought on later cut out him saying nigger. I was like, why'd you do that? He's like, it was a white editor. I just didn't think he called Dick Gregory a nigger. I'm like, no, that's not what he's doing. So again, I left it because like, no, he's talking the way black people talk to each other.
And you had the power to leave that kind of stuff in a way that maybe you didn't at CNN.
Yeah, that I wouldn't have had that, you know, certainly they wouldn't have let that. But yeah, so I got to like, no. You did something you weren't told to do. Put it back in. You're a good editor, but learn how I'm doing this.
What about all the comedians who you tried to get in who said no? Did you ever hear from any of them again about like, oh, maybe I should have done it? Or
no, nobody said I should have done it.
Yeah.
Well, no, that's not true. There was no comedians that I should. There have been people who are like, I wish you'd called me. That has happened. Yeah. But no major comedian has said I should have done it. I mean, I give Trevor Noah credit that when I did The Daily Show, he was on it. He's like, yeah, you asked me and I didn't do it. But he said, I just didn't have a thing for Cosby. So fair enough. But he admitted, fair. He admitted out loud that I wasn't going to be on The Daily Show and be like, you said you didn't, I asked you. I always said I was never going to out anybody, but he outed himself, which gives him credit.
I remember you calling me and you said, hey, I'm doing this documentary about Bill Cosby. Would you like to be in it? And I was like, no.
Yeah.
There is no reason I would want to be part of this documentary. But no, but in all honesty, it's because, I know this is strange to say, Bill Cosby just was not a cultural influence in my life.
No, we talked about that. Yeah. We talked about that.
And it was so weird to me because I'm glad I've watched this documentary you made because now I truly understand how big Bill Cosby actually was. So tell me why. Why do you think we need to talk about Cosby?
I appreciate you talking about that phone call because I got a lot of no's from a lot of people, and I've been very clear about, other than obviously Hannibal Buress, I haven't said who said no, so thank you for outing yourself here.
Oh, yeah.
So nobody has come to me and said, I think it is still a thing that is like a difficult subject. I mean, one of the best things that came out of it was Lily Bernard, who's all throughout the doc, and she's mainly in the third episode, and she said, and I hope this is still the case, that's the number of online trolls who were sort of like spamming her and trolling her went down. So somehow the doc coming out sort of like quieted some trolls.
You wouldn't think that, but
I think somehow like maybe those people, I don't know, but she said it. And I was like, well, mission, if that's the one thing that came out of it, there have been other things that come out of it. Like, I think the conversation is happening in a different way, even with like, and I'm not linked to like Surviving R. Kelly, linked to like the Cosby doc, linked to all these other things that have happened in culture. But yeah, that it's a part of. But yeah, I think that, so for me, that's the fact that the survivors who are in it, they all came to the Emmys. We lost to Get Back and Obama.
So I mean, what are you going
to
do?
Yeah, Peter Jackson and the Beatles, it's a hard combination. And Obama doing narration. But they all came. They're all happy to be there. So for me, the fact that the community of survivors who are in it don't feel like they were well served. But yeah, it's definitely like a thing where I think for the rest of my life, there will be rooms I walk into and be like, but a lot of those rooms I wasn't in the first place. So it's like, you know, I'm not hanging out with those. I live in Oakland. I'm not hanging out with those people. But
do you feel more ambitious about documentaries than stand up?
Do I feel more ambitious about documentaries? I feel like there are certain stories that I'm like, here's how my brain works. This is a documentary. This is a stand up bit. So I think there's reasons why both these art forms exist. So like, I feel like there are things I can accomplish with documentaries that I can't accomplish with stand up, but then there's things I can accomplish with stand up that I can't accomplish with a documentary. But the thing is like documentary requires a lot more resources and a lot more green lights, whereas Berkeley Rep required like a phone call and a couple of emails.
So yeah, it's just totally different.
It's just totally different. But I do think that like, you know, I can direct documentaries for a much longer time than I can do stand-up comedy. So I do like the idea that like, oh, this is a thing I could, this is, I really, I'm excited about the genre.
So now I want to do our segment called The First Laugh, which you've done before, but we've added some questions to it. So we can try some new ones. Looking back at the early days of your stand-up career, do you remember the first joke that really worked, that you felt like you had something, you were getting a good response, something that you wrote that really connected with people.
Is this a different question you've asked me before?
I don't think I asked you this one.
Okay, because I feel like I probably, it's the same response. I mean, this joke is so stupid. Okay, I'll tell this version of it. The first time I was ever on stage, and I only told this joke, and it's only barely a joke, I only told it once. But I remember a comic telling me that was a good joke. And I never told again, because I think even I know, I was like, this is barely a joke. But like, but it was the first thing I said on stage, first time ever on stage. It was dating stories, like about like, and I think I at the time, I think I was telling jokes about there's a newspaper in Chicago called The Reader, which is like the SF Weekly. And this was back when personal ads were a thing you put in the newspaper. Like I said, I'm old. And I did some personal ad dating in the newspaper. And it went really poorly. And the thing I said on stage is like, I thought I was at the end of my rope, but it turns out I got a closet full of rope. Okay. So like at the time I said it, it got a little bit of laugh. And a comedian who was an established comedian is like, that's a good joke, that closet full of rope thing. And I was like, oh, so it was like the first thing I said on stage that somebody told me was funny that probably encouraged me to go back the next week, although I never said it again.
Yeah. You're like, I've got that one out of my system.
Yeah. I don't even know what that means. Like, I don't even know what, that all sounds like a weird, like, am I talking about self-harm? You know, like,
yeah, that's where my brain went.
Exactly. But see, that's because I was 21 and I was like, and I don't even know if I had it written down. But yeah, no, it was just like, that was a comedian told me that it was funny. And so I was like, Patty Vasquez, who's still in Chicago, that I was like, oh. And then she would be like, how come you don't do that joke anymore?
Yeah, so I think that's what you need, that little bit of encouragement your first time. I think there's probably a lot of comedians out there who didn't get that, and maybe they only did it that one time.
Yeah, so I think that like that's the thing that like kept me coming back, and then but also smart enough to like, that's not really a joke.
Do you remember the first time that you felt successful as a comedian, like you maybe weren't going to have a day job anymore, or something had changed where you knew that you could actually do this as a career?
Man. That's such a hard, like, because I kept day jobs for a long time. I really got over the thing of, like, I was early to the idea of, like, don't quit your day job. I mean, it was wrong, but when I got Premium Blend.
Yeah, you're like, I've made it.
I made it. I got Premium Blend. It was like, I don't think it was the Damon Wayans was hosting. I had a good set. I felt, like, really good on that episode. It was also the days of, like, there was not virality in the way of YouTube, but, like, Dane Cook's Premium Blend set had made him like, it was the first thing into, little did I know he was on MySpace. But anyway, like it felt like maybe this will be the thing, but I did it and it felt good. And then, and I had a joke about Barack Obama, who was not even running for president at the time. Yeah. And it was 2003, it was 2005. Yeah. 2005, because he had spoken at the Democratic National Convention and people were like, that guy's going to be, and the joke was about how people said he was going to be the first black president. And my joke was like, he's never going to be the president, which is of course hilarious now. And so I felt like, I remember like coming off that stage, and that was also the same year, I think I got Montreal, like I was new faces. And so that year I felt like I'm going to have to move to LA and I'm going to have to da 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 da. And I went to Montreal without an agent or a manager. And I came out of Montreal without an agent or manager. Like, so like it was a year
didn't
where
change
I,
as much as
I
you
thought
you
things were going to shift. And then I think like, it's funny, like when I did the bell curve, I was like, I don't know if this is going to make me financially successful, but this is the best work I've ever done in my career. And so a little bit like, I'm just enjoying myself. So, but yeah, that was and then I'm trying to think about like, I guess I just don't have that idea. I think as I keep putting more pressure on myself, like even having three kids, it's like, even now I'm like, am I going to make it in this business?
Yeah. Yeah. You talked in your set that I saw about sort of being a very specific level of celebrity, which includes often being mistaken for Questlove. Do you have a story about the first time that you were recognized or felt like famous in any way?
Yes. Yeah, so this was actually early. I remember this. I had moved here. I'd moved to the Bay Area. This is 97. I'd done stand up for 3 years in Chicago, and I moved to but there was just not, the scene had sort of collapsed as far as like the clubs. There's an independent scene, but the club scene had collapsed. There was just Zanies, and they had the 10 comics they needed. And so I moved here, and somehow, because when I'd visited here, you know Gene Pompa? Gene Pompa is a comic from, I mean, he's still around. I'm sure he's still around. Gene Pompa was like a comic who in the 90s was like one of the alt comics who was like on all the Comedy Central stand-up shows. So I had met him at Cobb's when I came to visit, and Gene was like, call the punchline, tell him to give you a guest set. I don't know why he would have told me to do that. I did. I got a guest set. So when I moved in town, I called the punchline again, like, hey, I've moved here. Somehow, I don't know why this happened. They gave me a guest set on Margaret Cho was in town, and she was like, you know, from here, and sold out. I got a guest set on a Margaret Cho show. I don't know why they would have done that. I had no credits. I got a guest set on the Margaret Cho show. I did a guest set. I had a good set. I watched the show. I got on the BART to go back to Oakland where I was living. And somebody on the BART was like, weren't you just on the Margaret Cho show? can I get an autograph?
An autograph.
So I signed it. It was like, at the time, yeah. I thought, it's my first autograph. I probably signed 6 cents. Yeah. Autographs aren't really what they used to be. But that night, I was like, I've made a good decision to move to San Francisco. Yeah, I just signed an autograph on the BART. Yeah, so that was the was the first time I felt like I just never had been in a... I'd been doing comedy for 3 years in Chicago anonymously. I moved to the Bay Area and I signed an autograph. So
yeah. That's big.
And I was like, I'm going to be here about 2 years. I moved to L.A., get on Saturday Night Live.
Finally, is there a story or memory from your career that makes you laugh now, but really was not funny when it happened?
Man, so you're talking about failure.
Basically. It's a tragedy plus time equals comedy kind of thing.
I mean... I was still in Chicago. It's like 2 or 3 years into stand-up comedy. Yeah, so like, so there had been a club called, I think it was called, what was it called? Funny, it was like, it was called, I can't remember what it was called, but it was a club in Chicago. Bill Hicks used to perform there all the time, and it closed, but the guy reopened it as a new club. It was called The Fallout, like a fallout shelter. So it was like the new club in town, and everybody was excited because, like I said, Zanies had like the 10 comics they needed, and there wasn't a lot of stage time. So I got a guest set at the Fallout on like a Saturday night pack show. You know, I'm still like basically just an open micer who every now and again gets to do club shows, but like it was one of those clubs where also like the MC is really a headliner because he's got to do a lot of time, and he's also like got to like hand out raffle tickets and anniversaries and birthdays. And so before I went up, he was like, here's a trivia question to win tickets to the club. What's the name of the blue Power Ranger? Some sort of question about like Power Rangers. And some black woman was like, it's blah, blah, blah. And she got it. He's like, yeah. And she got her free tickets and everybody clapped. And I went on stage because I was so woke even back then. It's like, man, black people, we don't know our history, but we know who the blue Power Ranger is. The crowd immediately turned on me. As they should have.
They didn't like that.
What?
They didn't like that?
No, what was I doing? The fuck am I doing? This is probably a mom. Like, yeah. Also, you know, she's probably a mom. Yeah. She knows who the blue Power Rangers is.
You don't want to start by insulting the crowd.
Yeah, and also, like, why this random black lady? Like, what is wrong with you? Like, and then I tried to segue into my act, and I was on that stage for probably 30 seconds. I got booed off the stage.
Oh, man.
I mean, it was, and then you just sort of walk to the back of the, back to the, where the comics are standing, and they're all sort of looking at you. And I remember a comic named Mike Lucas said, sometimes you eat the bear, sometimes the bear eats you. And I will never forget that. Like, I was just like, even now I get sweaty thinking about it. I don't think I've ever gotten booed off the stage since. I've been booed, but not like where I was like, well, time
gotta
to go.
Leave.
Well, thank you. That's been my time. And then another time, this was actually funny. In Sacramento, at the Sacramento Comedy Club, I was one night, for some reason, I was opening for Wanda Sykes Hall. Wanda Sykes Hall. Recent divorcee, Wanda Sykes Hall. Had done the Chris Rock show. And I was doing bad. And at the end of the set, I said, thank you. I've been Debbie Kamau Boo. And that made Wanda laugh. And I was really like, oh. Even though I'd bombed, Wanda thought it was funny that I said, I've been Debbie Kamau Boo.
Yeah. And the crowd probably didn't know that was a joke.
No, they didn't know. They didn't give a shit. But Wanda thought it was funny. But yeah, the Fallout thing was like such a lesson in like, who the fuck do you think you are?
Yeah. Yeah.
Be funny. And also, why are you picking? It's really like, why are you picking on this? Pick on the people who need to be picked on.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and also like, there's a way to talk about what happened to connect to get the first laugh, but not by shitting on this person. Yeah. So, and also, I'm not the vibe of comic who can shit on people. Like, some comics can shit on people.
Yeah, you're not an insult comic.
I'm not that guy. Like, you know, like, yeah, Jim Norton could have done it. Not that he would have done the Black History part of it, but yeah. You know, and it would have been fine. But I'm not that guy.
Well, Kamau, this was so much fun. I'm so glad we got to do this third time in person. Yeah.
Three Timers Club
in the Bay Area.
Yeah. What do I have to do to get on four times? Something's gonna have to happen.
I think we can make it happen.
Mark Twain.
I think
Award.
We can figure it out. Oh, yeah. let's hook that up.
Yeah, yeah.
Just talk to Kevin Hart.
You just go.
All right, man. Thank you.
Thanks.
This was great. All right. I want to thank W. Kamau Bell for meeting up with me in person for this interview. You can see him right now on ABC's hidden camera show, What Would You Do? And if you happen to be in the Bay Area, definitely look out for his next run of shows at Berkeley Rep whenever he gets his act together again. I also want to thank Allegra Frank for joining at the top of this show. I'm so excited that she is going to be a big part of this show moving forward, so stay tuned for that as well. If you want to support The Last Laugh, please help us out by leaving a rating and review on Apple and Spotify. We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Threads at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram and Threads, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes and see who is coming up next on the show. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.